Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and we have some wonderful Paradigm Shifters with us today. I would like to say two. One who's very much on the earth, Kathleen Kingdon, and I'm awfully pleased to have you here, Kathleen.
Thank you.
And the being that you channeled, Dwal Cool. Somebody I studied, my only channeling class, I studied from him many, many years ago. So this is a double honor for me to meet with you and Dwal Cool on this paradigm-shifting show. And as I say to everyone listening, I call them paradigm shifters because there's a huge shift going on the planet. And some of these precious beings who come in for interviews are making a big difference in helping that shift along so we can all evolve. Anyway, let's get to work and talk with Dwal Cool, or talk with you, Kathleen, about how long you've been channeling him and what... I have his wonderful book here, your wonderful book here. So I know some of the message he's bringing forth. Can you distill some of the message that he brings forth consistently?
Well, basically, I would say that a common theme through all these roughly 27 years of working together has been that we as humans are more than we perceive ourselves to be. And that it's only because we get caught in our various projections of limitations that we don't really realize who we are. And you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. In the past few years, he's been talking a lot about enlightenment. And many of your listeners probably will recognize that he also came through Alice Bailey. And in a way, it's kind of interesting because while the format is somewhat different, much of the message is very similar. And the whole idea of allowing ourselves to step into our greatness and really realize that we're bigger than all of the things that confuse us, that confound us, that limit us, or that we believe limit us, we're actually bigger than all of those things put together. So I would say that's a recurring theme. And then the other thing is just when people are in his presence, I think they feel remarkably loved. And often, well, I think sometimes that's a little difficult to always get from humans. It's a vaster, deeper, profounder love than most of us are able to share with each other. So without getting too wordy, as you can see, I'm very enthusiastic about talking about Master.
I love it. It's just wonderful. And I've been through most of the book, Matter of Mind, An Explorer's Guide to the Labyrinth of the Mind. And one of the questions I have is if you could explain how he teaches about karma and the mind. I love this book because it's actually easy to read in a way, but every phrase has got like a lot to chew on.
Well, that's exactly right, Veronica. I think... Actually, I'm delighted that you've sensed that about it, because what he said when we put the book together was he wanted to create a text in English that was very much like the way they did commentaries in Tibet, and when he was last on Earth, and in probably times prior to that. And he said, I intend a book with no fluff. I intend a book where there's no repeating a theme. In other words, people need to get it as they go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And what many people have said, I think when people try to speed read the book, they tend to be quite disappointed. And yet those who have taken the time to read it carefully, and by that I mean a few pages at a time, tend to say it's life-altering. And some people have read it as many as 6 and 7 times, and what they report is that every time they read it, it's like reading a new book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know that that's every single person's experience, but I've heard that quite a bit from people. So,
I'm just going to interrupt you for a sec. I was trying to read it fairly quickly because of this show, I could not read it very, very quickly, but I was conscious of it spiraling, like it takes you through some comprehension, and I know I will go back and get the nuggets of that chapter, but every chapter builds on itself in the sense of spiraling you through a self-awareness. I thought that was extremely potent.
Well, that was my take on it when we got the manuscript done, but of course I can't say that I'm a neutral party.
No, you can't. But we're glad you're there, believe me.
Thank you.
So I was wondering if you would talk about the mind and karma, because I had not had it, I've done a lot of studying in my many years of search, but I've never heard it put in that direction, in that way, that the mind is basically our karmic, it's built by karma, right?
Well, basically, there are many definitions of karma, and I think in the West, we've become kind of accustomed to hearing that karma is the law of cause and effect or something like that, but that doesn't always take one deeply into the understanding of the area. And Master has said, well, if we go to a very subtle area or a subtle level of looking at the mind and at karma, what we discover is that virtually every movement of the mind is karma, or the fact that the mind even moves is karma. And he will give examples such as, you know, when you ask a person what their favorite color is. You know, there's nothing good or bad about colors.
No.
In other words, there's no reason why blue should be better than red for some people or vice versa. And yet, people do have an inclination to favor one color over the rest. And he will say, well, why is this? It's because the mind, having traveled through many lifetimes, perhaps being recycled and, in a way, redefined with each lifetime, but there are certain proclivities that have come about over lifetimes that aren't really explicable. Who knows why some people prefer blue to red or to pink or whatever? Who knows why? There isn't really a reason why, other than the fact that the mind moves in that direction.
Do you mean it's sort of like trained by experience?
Exactly.
Okay.
But it's very, very subtle. And it's a kind of training that I think very few of us are even aware that we're undergoing or creating. We just think, well, that's just the way it is. To me, blue's prettier.
So what is, okay, so individually, then we build up a responsive kind of a network of thoughts and feelings and proclivities and so on. Is that what you're saying, kind of?
Right. In fact, I live in an area that's very sunshiny. Colorado, at least on the eastern slope, has over 300 days of sunshine a year. Now, out in the northwest where, or excuse me, the northwest where you are, mm-hmm. basically that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And I have met people in my travels in the northwest who didn't particularly like sunshine. Now, I can't understand that because I love it. But there is probably some reason down there that who knows how many lifetimes ago it was hidden, that wherein the mind caught on to either I prefer sunshine or I prefer rain. Intrinsically, one is not better than the other, but some of us see one as being better than the other. And so our life is full of all of these, well, may I say, repeating cycles that we may not even recognize are repeating. We just think that sunshine is better or rain is better. And so while they are our proclivities, they've probably been built up over lifetimes. And what Master says is that in every lifetime, we sort of layer onto the karmic projections that we carry with us. And of course, what he says, the way the mind works is that it projects an idea or a notion about anything. It could be about favorite colors, it could be about favorite weather, but it might also be about politics. In fact, in one lecture that he did, I think he kind of surprised people in saying, well, your political bent has much more to do with your karma than it has to do with your belief in your freedom of choice. In other words, he says that people come in and they will have proclivities based on their experiences in other lifetimes to align with perhaps a more right-winged approach or a more left-winged approach, and others will be someplace along that spectrum. But basically, while we think it's all coming about as a matter of something that we're either learning or maybe we're asserting ourselves in the now, his take on it is that we have karmic proclivities that we should question. It's not that they're wrong or they're bad, but his idea is that we are more powerful when we bring all of this into our conscious process rather than just functioning on an unconscious level and believing that Democrats are better than Republicans or vice versa, that the Republican Party is further along than the Democrats and so on. But there are so many, many areas. In fact, it's probably bordering on infinite.
Mm-hmm.
How many areas there are that we sort of honor these inner projections, or this is the way it is for me, or this is the way it is for someone else, and we don't even really realize that we're just repeating something that has been true for us in the past.
It was fascinating to me because I felt like I was in kind of an ocean of belief or structured expectations, and I was fascinated by that because they come collectively as well as individually, don't they?
They do.
Yeah. So can you tell people at home a little bit about what he says about is it escaping or stepping out of that karmic, the subjective reality that's designed by karma, for example?
Well, this is, I suppose it feels a little bit different to each person. I'm not sure that there is any one way to transcend one's karma. I think we all work at it, however we work at it. But the idea, basically, is that our consciousness is much vaster than what we call our minds. And I know for some people that probably sounds like we're splitting some kind of a hair. But if he often says...
Not for our listeners, I think. They're pretty attuned, yeah.
Well, he would often say that consciousness is like the sky, vast and open. And the mind is like the progression of clouds. They float through the sky. They have really no effect on the sky. It is precisely as pristine now as it ever was. And that part doesn't change. So we could say that the sky is real, maybe with a capital R. Mm-hmm. And the clouds, because they're changeable, they're passing, they float in and out, and they take different forms and shapes and do different functions, all of that, they're very transient. Mm-hmm. And so he would say that the mind is like clouds. It's very transient. That when we leave a body and then perhaps take another body, we try to configure some kind of a mind that draws on what we have known in the past, but will somehow serve us in whatever it is we have to learn in the life that we're beginning to undertake. And so if we can have this sense that there is something that is very, very vast in which we all participate, and then there's our personal take on it. In other words, some people see, if you take an issue like global warming, mm-hmm. many people see it as reality, but there are those who actually see it as some big hoax that has been perpetrated by some force or factor that wants to kind of mess everybody up. And so when we look, there is the issue that something is going on the planet. And then each of us will, based on our own experiences, interpret that somehow so it fits with our own projection. Mm-hmm. And what he says is that the mind can only work through projecting its reality. And it works this way so that when we project, we have the privilege or the opportunity, perhaps sometimes the chagrin, of seeing how we projected something. Mm-hmm. And the net idea here is to realize that we are bigger, vaster, more spacious than all of our projections put together.
So it tells us to go. So I love the way he says, what is it? Like if you see somebody doing something, it seems like that person, or it looks like that person is going to steal your partner, or it seems like you are entering a car, right?
Right.
Isn't that a technique for getting yourself less attached to what the illusion is?
Well, I think basically it serves some purpose to see it in whatever way we see it. But we have to always recognize that we're only seeing it the way our mind lets us see it. So while something is always happening, indeed, we could define getting into a car as something that is real. And certainly it is really experienced. But he draws a line between what is real and what is, he says, only really experienced. And he would say that we aren't often in as strong of touch with what's really going on as we are in touch with what we really experience. And we do experience those things. When somebody irritates us, we do experience that irritation or frustration or anger. But that's not all that's going on. And perhaps our mind has something to do with how we received whatever information it was that we allowed to irritate us or confuse us.
I mean, it already had some choice as far as what we like, what we prefer, what we categorize, like all short women.
Yeah.
We already have some preconceived attitude, right?
Exactly.
It's very interesting. So what do we do, Kathleen? What do we do to get beyond it?
Well, one of the things that Master suggests, and I tried this at one point in my life and was amazed with how powerful it was, is really we get up and we invoke sort of on an ongoing basis seeing the truth. And there's different ways of doing it. I think the Rompha people have a phrase that's called "Let the truth come forth." So I believe Rompha used to use that. I'm not that much in touch with that group at this point. But at any rate, I think there is something very powerful in saying out loud what we want to have occur for us. Now, some people, let's say, want to maybe attract a certain partner. Other people want to attract a certain job. Other people want to attract a certain amount of money into their life. Mm-hmm. And all of these are fine. But he says the highest use of this ability to attract is to really invite the truth to manifest in front of us so profoundly that we can't miss what's going on. Now, if one is going to invoke the truth in their life, they need to have an agreement with themselves that they'll really look at it, that they'll scrutinize the events and the situations. And so let's say I get up in the morning and I say, let the truth come forth this day. Mm-hmm. And then I go out and do whatever I'm doing. Maybe I go to the grocery store and I'm going, pushing the cart and going down the aisle, and someone comes around the corner very fast and rams their basket into mine. And I realize that had I been just a few feet forward, the person wouldn't have hit the basket, they'd have hit me. And so, you know, and this is a very simplistic thing, but maybe I say, oh, I wonder if I'm trying to learn by sudden impact. And I then look at my life and see what kinds of things are impacting me, or how am I allowing these things that are going on to impression me. You know, as many of you know, we're coming up on Tax Celebration Day, as Master calls it, some other names for it. But for some of us, that requires a whole lot of preparation, and often it's preparation we'd rather not do. But as we look at that, say, oh, a Tax Celebration Day is coming. Is it a celebration for me? Or is it something else? How am I allowing this event that comes around every year to impact me this year? And are there any surprises that arise suddenly that I hadn't been aware of? Or does my accountant give me some information I don't want to hear, or so on? I mean, it can be with virtually anything. But the idea is to use the mind to cut through the mind. And that's kind of an interesting thing, I think, for most of us to grapple with. And at least for me, it's been a process of a lot of years of trying to understand deeply what these teachings are all about.
So you're saying that when there's a conflict inside of ourselves and so on, push it out to make a bigger meaning for it, more of a lesson for us.
Well, I think so. And I think if we're really aligned and tuned in, that conflict's going to manifest in our life some way that kind of hits us in the face. And I think our job is to not be undone by that, you know, whether we go to anger or whether we go to depression or anything along that spectrum. Our job is to take a deep breath and say, wait a minute, what can I learn from this? And then to notice, how is it my mind wants to move with this? Do I want to blame somebody else? Am I feeling critical? Am I feeling depressed, maybe? Hopeless about something? Am I completely overwhelmed by the situation or the circumstance or the information? Or am I just centered? Am I just, as Master has said, can I just be a high witness to my own process? And that's probably easier said than done.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's a bit of a challenge, but that, I believe that's the challenge we're all working with right now, isn't it?
Well, I would agree.
So if we come to something like 2012, so we have an awful lot of built-in expectations, fears. I'm not afraid of it particularly, but there's a lot of information out there in the collective to scare people, to make it a real event that's got all kinds of built-in projections, isn't it?
Oh, I couldn't agree more, and it reminds me somewhat of, you know, 1999 going
into Y2K, yeah.
Many, many people would come to Master and they'd say, what are we going to do when this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens? And he very calmly would say, well, I'd advise that you have at least one contingency plan. I mean, what if the world doesn't fall apart? Are you prepared to go forward, or are you just kind of stuck here waiting for the world to fall apart? And some people were a little offended by that, and others thought it was very provocative. I mean, oh, contingency plan, everybody's waiting for the world to crash. And, of course, it didn't happen. And I think 2012 is another example. There is a whole lot of a mythos around this year, and Master has said it's likely to be a very powerful year. But rather than thinking that the Earth is going to, like, let's say, fall out of its orbital field or have some other kind of cataclysmic thing.
Or the zombies are coming out of the Earth.
Yeah, but maybe we should have a contingency plan. And maybe if we have a contingency plan, perhaps we can use the energies of the year to really launch us forward on our own individual paths and as well as on our group path.
And I think, yeah, I think that's how I'm understanding it, but I'm also understanding the clash with the collective fear. I guess it's that, or the collective expectation, which usually isn't true.
Right.
Usually predictions don't work either. It's a similar
right.
thing.
Right. Well, for whatever it's worth, Master has designated the year 2010 the year of fearlessness. And students who have had, been around for a while are probably wondering, oh, what might that mean? But he's really encouraging us to, and this, I guess some people think this is rather bizarre, but he's really encouraging all of us to look at our death.
Okay.
Because he says that's the one thing that basically every other fear is based on. We may not recognize it, but often the fears that we experience in life are really connected to, you know, it, back there, way, 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 in the back part of the mind, there's some little voice telling us, well, I could die mm-hmm. if this happens. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if I'm found out in this situation, it feels like it could be death. It might be death to a relationship. It might be death to a phase of my life.
Well, and I notice when people have, like, deep karmic attractions for each other, there's a feeling, if I don't get that, I'll die. And that also is something that we work on.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So basically, it's kind of interesting. We're just now kicking off, of course, 2010, and the evening of the 15th, I'm actually going to be in Portland, Oregon, and we're going to have a lecture there, and he's probably going to talk a little bit about what he sees for 2010. And so I, like everybody else, am kind of anxious to see what he lays out for us.
Tell me this. Do you hear, when you're channeling him, do you hear?
It's kind of an interesting thing. I don't hear mm-hmm. ahead of time. I hear it when it comes out, just like everybody else. And so whatever this link is, or however we describe it, in my case, I do not hear anything ahead of time. It's sort of, I hear it when everybody sitting in the audience hears it. Or if I'm doing, say, a lecture that goes out to our subscribers, who we have a Teaching of the Month subscription through our organization, the Vajra Flame Foundation. And if I'm doing that, it sort of comes out when he's recording it. Mm-hmm. There will be some times when I'm working on something. We also do monthly contributions to the Sedona Journal of Emergence. And there'll be some times he'll ask me to look some things up on the Internet or whatever before we do that. And then I sort of have whatever he has there. And I think basically it's his way of preparing my mind for where he's going to go with the teaching.
Because your mind has to be open, doesn't it, to receive a much higher frequency than maybe your karma has bred into your mind. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. And actually, when I began working with Master, goodness, we're coming up on 27 years now.
Wow.
It's kind of hard to believe.
Wow, wonderful.
But probably the first year and a half, he told me, set aside your Saturdays. And so we would spend about 8 hours every Saturday working on clearing my subconscious mind. And he had me do all kinds of exercises, and I started keeping them in binders, and I had about 10 of these 3-inch binders full of all this material. And one day he said, why are you keeping all that around? It's stuff you've gotten rid of, isn't it? So it was a fairly intensive training program to work with him. And at the time, it felt a little bit burdensome to have to do this every weekend, but basically I think in the long run it was very helpful in exactly what you're talking about, learning how to just kind of turn off Kathleen's mind and be open and allowing something else to come through.
I'm sure our listeners are a little bit, they wish they had the purification tools that you have, it seems. But he does use the word purification a lot, doesn't he?
He does. Mm-hmm. And actually, he used that quite a bit through Alice Bailey as well. Mm-hmm. And I've never read Alice's work. He told me in the original state he'd prefer that I didn't. He wanted our work to be authentic.
Okay.
But over the Christmas holidays, I spent it with a friend in Philadelphia who has all of Alice's work. And so I began just kind of looking through these books in the evenings, and I noticed, oh, purification and service. Where have I heard those two words?
And also, I was looking through this month's newsletter,
mm-hmm.
and I noticed, I want to go back into this subject, which I think is brilliant. He talks about purification, but he also talks about food and agri-food and so on. Have you had to go into a really strong dietary purification yourself?
Actually, well, I haven't to date, and he's told me that 2010 is definitely the year to do it. Now, when I first started working with him, I had several months where all I had was one cup of rice with a little butter on it three times a day, and he said, "Don't eat anything else."
Oh my.
And he feels that rice has a particular a component that's very purifying to the physical body. And I must confess that as we've gotten into 2010, I found my life so complicated I haven't gotten around to it yet. But he told me that in January he really wanted me and others who were willing to do so to really work on purifying the body.
Well, and he also mentioned the agribusiness where they're doing a genetic engineering on foods and so on in this. Do you want to say something about that? Because that's a really big subject for purification and what are we going to do about that sort of thing?
Well, in the article that you're referencing, basically, he said at one point, I believe, that he thought that in 2010, we might find that as much as 85% of the food that's in our produce, particularly in the big chains of our produce grocery stores, is likely to be genetically altered. And since the people who are genetically altering the seeds don't have to really confess that they're doing that, it makes it a little bit hard on the consumer because we don't actually know what it is we're getting.
Right.
But in addition to that, and I don't think he said this in that article, I think he was telling this to someone in a personal session recently, that it's more than just the genetically altered foods, that the meat that we get in this country is loaded with hormones. And he feels that that's part of the reason why we have such horrendous infections, is that some of these things, because the hormones create, they make us susceptible to other things, and it causes some of the bacteria and viruses to mutate so that they're very, very strong and the antibiotics don't work anymore. He feels like there is some bleed over from the foods that we're eating. And he told someone recently, and I'm sorry, I don't recall a great deal of what goes on in personal sessions. I do remember this, however, that most of Europe will not buy American meats of any kind, and that Russia now has also begun to see our meats as too toxic an export for them to bring into their public. So there's, I think, this whole area of what is it we're putting into our bodies is probably going to be a pretty big theme for 2010.
Great.
And I think his idea was that if we can just be more aware. I believe also in that article he said that 2010 was a year that probably more people will go organic than ever have previously, simply because as more and more comes out about the nature of the food that we eat, more and more people will be wanting to get farther and farther away from it. He also recommended that people who produce their own gardens might want to begin ordering their seeds from European countries, because it's much less likely that they're going to get contaminated with any kind of seeds that have been genetically modified.
Hmm.
I think it's definitely a topic of our time.
It really is. I was quite impressed by that. Do you think that Jawal Kuhl would like to come through you and speak with us today?
I'm sure he would.
And I love what you're talking about. It's not that. You really?
Oh, no. I think that would be delightful. Hang on just a couple of seconds. It doesn't take very long, and I'll get him.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, good evening.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm very happy to be speaking with you. I'm enjoying life in 2010. Thank you.
Wonderful. It is an incredible time, is it not?
It is. It's paradoxical and a lot of polarity, isn't there?
There certainly is, and I think, if anything, we're going to probably see more of it as the year goes along.
Well, how do you think we're doing as a species? Are we rising in consciousness? Are we moving out of that karmic, what you call the tyranny of the mind? Are we moving out of that collectively?
Well, when I wrote the book, this is something I was trying to really bring home into the minds of individual people. There is a way where I think the 20th century, now we're in the 21st century, has lent itself to facilitating people to pay actually less attention rather than more attention. And I think the most, in fact, I would call it the last frontier, really, is that of the emotional mind. And I think if you look around the world today, you can see all kinds of areas where the emotional mind isn't quite tame as yet. Now, that being said, of course...
It's a nice way to put it.
Yes. That being said, there are all manner of people who are really trying to contribute to the planetary process, and I'm delighted about that. But what I have, I guess, to say to many people is that, you know, some people have begun to notice that in the past few years it seems as if they're working on much more than their own stuff. And, you know, this is true. Actually, it is a time of purifying a planet. So those who are ready and are, let's say, able, will be working on not only their own karma, which has amassed over many lifetimes, but they'll also be working on the karma of the planet. And I have to say that for many people, this is kind of a message that stops them in their tracks. And I've had my students say to me, well, Master, I don't know how to manage my own karma. How in the world will I be able to manage the karma of the planet? And I tell them it's very much like managing your own karma. It's mm-hmm. just one step at a time. And so as we together move forward, it becomes very important to mobilize the great we. In other words, it's time that we stretch beyond the individual ego mm-hmm. and the individual personality and really try to create. I mean, it's more than just discovering. We must create this group experience of the we. And, you know, I would like to capitalize the W because I'm talking about a holy coming together. I'm talking about a vast vehicle of consciousness that is able to receive the earth in love, no matter what is going on, and really function as, well, as what it is, a vast force of light. And it is a little interesting as people try to figure out just what do I do as a single person? Does that mean I'll cease to be a single individual? Well, no, it doesn't. But it does mean that one learns to give a little less importance to the desires, the wants, and so on of their own ego and begins to look at a broader picture of what does the planet need and how is it that I have taken birth at this time. And how is it that I am here at this interesting, somewhat chaotic time? Mm-hmm. And, you know, to own that the fact that I am here must mean something. And thus it then becomes the task, I guess you could say, of the individual to make his or her own life really meaningful.
And to make the decisions as a part of, you mean as a responsibility for the collective as well, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's tricky. As I said, this has to be created. It's not something that there's a good model out there mm-hmm. that, you know, demonstrates how to do this.
So let me ask you this. If we, like the economic world, there's a lot of, like, control issues, power and greed and so on. But I think there's a transformation possible on the way the economy runs around the world. Are you speaking of this as a kind of an example where we all take responsibility for that?
Well, yes. You've actually put your finger on something that is really important here. And that is that one of the reasons, I think, that greed and corruption has become so seemingly powerful these past few years or decades has been the fact that many people feel overwhelmed mm-hmm. by the power of the financial area, whether it's Wall Street or the banks or whatever. And frankly, that has allowed them to kind of feel like they're above the law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't need to give a lot of examples. I think everybody can think of something they've seen or heard or experienced personally that demonstrates this. And so this is a time of really calling these people to task. Now, we do it at the individual level, but we do it on behalf of the planet because these old, may I say, techniques of greed and corruption and power over mm-hmm. are outdated.
You know, good.
Yeah, we have to look beyond it, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you recommend, is it about observing and about taking responsibility for it as if we're the ones who run Goldman Sachs or?
Well, this is where it gets very interesting. You do have to kind of look at all these people that have had a hand in, let's say, complicating things for most people. You have to look at them as other pieces of yourself. And we kind of have to look at them and say, well, now, this may be a stretch, but we have to do it anyway. Well, if they really knew what they were doing, they wouldn't do this. Let me give you an example. If you have a 4 or 5-year-old who's playing with matches and burns down the house, mm-hmm. It's a tragedy, but people will say, well, he just didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. And then if you have someone that's 35 who sets fire to the house, that's a different matter. Mm-hmm. And that person finds himself or herself prosecuted by the law because the culture deems a person of that age to know what they're doing. Well, in some ways, when you look at a world that has been so full of, particularly in the recent years, this kind of greed and corruption, we see it in politics, we see it certainly in the financial industry, but we also see it creeping into other areas as well, literally poisoning the minds of many, many people. Mm-hmm. When we look at that, we have to say, you know, if these people really knew what they were doing, they wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking about if they were spiritually mature enough to realize that their actions have consequences that will come back to them. Mm-hmm. And they may, the consequences may be difficult for other people in the now, but I guarantee you it's going to be quite difficult for the perpetrators of these corrupt systems. And so we have to look at these people as immature spiritually. And I think if you hold them without looking down on them, but to look at them as just being immature, then there's a way where we can feel compassion even for people who seem to be benefiting quite nicely when the bonuses are passed out in these large financial institutions and certainly Wall Street as well. If you can't look at it that way, it's kind of hard to bring it into a perspective where you can feel compassion. But ultimately, that's the goal, is to look at humanity the way a Buddha or a Jesus would do, mm-hmm. and without denying the mistakes they're making, mm-hmm. and without excusing them, mm-hmm. Because karma won't excuse them, mm-hmm. just to help them be responsible for the things they have set in motion. But we want to do it not on the edge of a vendetta. Mm-hmm. We want to do it from a space of compassion where we recognize, you know, if they were a little more mature spiritually, they wouldn't be able to engage in these practices.
So we have to do some compassionate activism, right?
Yes. And I think activism is actually good, mm-hmm. because it allows people to clarify what they believe about something.
And to actually not be disempowered or overwhelmed, as you mentioned.
Exactly.
Now, can I ask you about the Illuminati? What do you think about the cellular journeying that we're hearing about, which is, say, families who are reborn in a soul lineage that are also dominant?
Well, as you know, there are there's kind of two sides to the coin with the Illuminati, aren't there?
Yes.
And I think one has to really look at how their mind moves with just the consideration or the notion of the Illuminati. I think, you know, you can certainly look at the historical bloodlines in Europe. You can certainly look at, in fact, I was telling some of my students at one point that the people that run the Democratic Party, or the money behind it, the real force, is the same ones that run the Republican Party.
Yes.
And basically all of the infighting that occurs on television and in these political seminars or on tea parties or demonstrations or whatever, those are just kind of diversions so that those who are in power can continue. And so there is that version of the Illuminati, but then there's the other one, too, where it really draws from the power that's behind the name, the Illumined Ones, or Illuminated Ones. And so I think we have to say that this is an area that's really a mixed bag for many, many people. And I think as we look at the course of the planet, I think when we look at the name of the organization, it's not organized the way, in other words, it doesn't have any bylaws that are open for public reading. But nonetheless, when we look at the power in the name, we can clearly see that this can be, if used in the correct way, a force for good.
So it's like as above, so below. So you have your bell curve of good and evil. Is that
not exactly? But I know what you're saying. The patterns. You see, here's the thing. Let me give you another example that I think will help maybe understand this. If a child is told over and over that he or she is not good at math. In fact, several years ago, a student of mine was a teacher in a school, and I was just watching what was going on. And there was one child who he didn't seem to be particularly off the norm, but he could not learn math. And she came to me to talk to me about this student and what she could do. And I said, well, what you need to know is this young man's father introduces his son as, this is my son, Ricky. He's slow in math, you know.
Oh, my.
And so, in a way, this child modeled on that mantra. And so, you know, I said, it's likely that in this life he's never going to do very well. But if you can find ways of helping him grasp concepts that have nothing to do with the math book or problems on the board, then, you know, it's a lot of work, but that will probably be the best thing you can do for him. Well, like this situation, we have humans have had many, many lifetimes, each one, and in each lifetime they learn something about themselves. And if they have had, or take a person who has had a series of lifetimes where he or she learned, however, that there was something wrong with them,
mm-hmm.
that they weren't trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they come into this life, and of course they're trying to work on that. But what must manifest are all of these other beliefs about who they might be before they have to cut through them before they can ever see who they really are. And so while you could say there is, I know certainly in Christian mythology, the idea of Lucifer, the fallen angel, and all of his angelic hosts who are kind of on the other side, it's probably as close as we can get. But I think it's very important for people not necessarily to think that's the way it is, but to really think maybe this is a metaphor because that's the way we are. And so we have this spiritual teaching that tells us something about perhaps this being a pattern from another realm. As I see it, and again, everyone has their own perspective on creation, but as I see it, these, let's say, these evil forces tend to be holographic projections of people's perceived weaknesses. And, you know, it's very interesting because the creative mind is so...
You mean our own perceived weaknesses?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
And they get projected on a realm that is seen as more powerful. And so in the most fundamentalist level, you'll have someone say, well, the devil made me do that. I'm not responsible for hitting that person. And, you know, a little further along, someone would say, well, yeah, you are responsible. But depending on the level of spiritual maturity, these things have a wide range of appearance. And so I think there it is as above, so below, but the below hasn't exactly figured out how it is above. Because when you are in this vast, open spaciousness of pure consciousness, there's no need for disagreement. I mean, you have respect for what everybody believes. Mm-hmm. And so how that might play out is, let's say, an advanced being comes to Earth and gets, maybe arrives in the United States along about election time. And he or she sees this great strife that goes on between the Democrats and the Republicans. And but the highly evolved being would think it's all curious. So how is it that these came to see the matter in this way, and these over here? Take health care reform. How is it that those on the left see it one way and those on the right see it so differently?
And they're so afraid of looking after the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That always struck me as kind of hilarious, actually. Like, this is really crazy.
Well, at one level, it is. Mm-hmm. It clearly is. Mm-hmm. But to people who are radically involved in it, it's life or death, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, and so you can see that their projections or the things that they have brought forward from other lives that appear to be true get projected onto the way that they see now. And so while you might be able to look at it and say, well, you know, we need health care, but, you know, maybe the president didn't do it in the way, I mean, who knows? There's all kinds of explanations for it, but the idea is that an evolved being can hold their center of neutrality. Mm. And basically this is the primary reference point for the framework of their life. And for humans working on getting there, you see, they see things in a whole lot of different ways. In other words, if someone breaks into your home with a gun and shoots one of your family members, many, many people want vengeance. Mm-hmm. And we can understand that at one level.
Sure.
But at another level, you have to say, if the person that did it really knew what he or she was doing, there's no way they would have done that.
Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
When we forgive people, this is an area that I think isn't maybe as clearly understood. A lot of times I have people come to me who have had, let's say, incestuous backgrounds. They have a lot of pain. And they come in and they say, well, I know I'm supposed to forgive the person that did this to me, but somehow I just can't. But the more I try, the more I feel like a failure. And often what I notice in someone like that is that they tend to go into a space of disassociation. Mm-hmm. In other words, they kind of check out from life because they can't forgive, and yet they feel like they're supposed to forgive.
Right.
And so I try to be very careful and direct with my explanation of forgiveness. It's not that you forgive the person for the act that he or she committed,
mm-hmm.
because it's not good to, let's say, incest a child or even to beat them or to persecute or abuse them in any way. But you forgive the person for falling into a place where he or she could do that. And you remember the times when you, too, have fallen from your ideal or your best self. You know, maybe you didn't really hurt someone, but maybe you got angry and you were maybe a little harsh in your criticism. Or maybe you didn't even say it out loud, but in your mind you were really taking the person on and as if it were life and death in some emotional way.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to do is come to a place where the primary point of anchoring is a point of neutrality. It doesn't mean one doesn't care. I sometimes use the phrase highly engaged neutrality. Hmm. And that means that the person is not checked out, they are totally in the moment, totally aware, and choosing to remain calm in their center.
Now tell me, because we're unfortunately coming to the end. I could talk to you all day. But if we do that, can we bring ourselves out of the karmic mind, the tyranny of the mind? And the other question I had to ask you, which is a huge question for the end of a show, but what happens then when we pass, when we transit? Do we unhook from more of the karma, and can we, can we make it out of here?
Well, yes, but let me say, I think it's chapter 10 in the book where we talk about death and the mind, mm-hmm. and I really go into what happens with the successive turning looses that occur in death. In other words, first you turn loose of the body, and then you have all these other, you have to turn loose of the mind as well. And part of that process is watching one's own mind unravel. And so I'll defer the last question to the book, because I think I give some information in there that's not readily available in any written form at this time. So
I just want to tell people this is a wonderful book, The Matter of Mind. It's a wonderful book.
But in terms of what does a person do in their life, you're right. The primary thing is learning to observe everything. In fact, what you kind of want to do is have this sense that you have a number of selves that are engaging in your body. Mm-hmm. And so if you can kind of think of your life as playing out on a stage, and there's a part of you that's up there playing the part, but then there's another part of you out in the audience that's watching. And this part is observing the whole scene, not just what's, let's say, arising in the playing out of that life. But then there's an even greater part of consciousness that's way in the back of the theater, who is watching not only what's going on in stage, but is watching the interpretations of the watcher, let's say in the middle part of the theater.
Hmm.
And when you begin to look at consciousness as something that is very vast and something that has a lot of layers, then you begin to have a sense of what it is to be truly human. And so you it isn't that you quit living the life that's playing out on stage. You have to do that. If you don't do it, you just come back and do the same thing again, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But then to engage these other deeper levels of consciousness is profound in terms of seeing what is really going on.
Mm-hmm.
So life is playing out, and there's how it appears to the person who's on the stage. And that's valid for whatever the person is trying to sort through in his or her own karmic field. But then, if we get a little distance on it, you can have an observer self that sits, let's say, halfway back in the theater, who maybe is calling the shots. And this part might be kind of a critical one. Well, why did I do that? Well, why can't I see this is going on? And, well, you should be doing this up there. And so on. But then in the back of the theater, there's this vaster level of consciousness that has nothing but love for both the person on the stage and the person who is observing, maybe the critical observer, watching what's going on the stage. And what we can say or project is that likely there are many other and deeper and vaster levels of consciousness that are therefore accessing as well. But I think if a person starts with these other two levels of being aware, I think that's enough to really penetrate most of the things that complicate one's lives, or the places where their karma isn't clear. Is that helpful?
Yes, very helpful.
Good.
And are you, how many times have you come to, what I'm asking is, you are such a profound being, and do you come to the earth all the time? Is this your job? Is this what you love to do? Who are you?
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. Certainly I have had my battery of lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the thing that is called ascension in, 1949. But anyway, so I haven't come back as a physical being. If I work through various people who are, willing to let me borrow their body and their speech and, the kind of their thought process for a while, then what that helps is that I can talk to more people than I could if I were in a single body. So I've kind of elected for this, but the question you ask is valid in that I am a part of what has been termed the spiritual hierarchy, and I frankly believe we're going to a new definition of that, and that's what I see more around 2012, is that there is a kind of process coming that's going to redefine the connection of the physical plane and the spiritual plane. And hopefully it's going to be a much more inclusive thing and a little bit less hierarchical, where we can all sort of go deeper and deeper into vaster and vaster levels of consciousness rather than having to kind of go up the ladder to see who deals with this and who do I talk to about this and so on and so forth, which has kind of been the mode of interacting between the planes. And so I have no immediate plans for coming back as a physical being, but I have a huge commitment to aiding individuals and certainly the planet Earth. It's a planet I dearly love. Mm-hmm. And in its process, and as probably most of your listeners realize, just as individuals have their spiritual path and their enlightenment, so do planets. And so that's what's so incredibly important about this time. It's that the Earth is working on her enlightenment. And, you know, I celebrate all of the wonderful people that want to be a part of that, who realize that perhaps of all of their lifetimes, this is the most important one, because Earth herself is standing at a critical juncture, you see?
We're doing it together. I thank you so much for your time and for your presence, and I'd be honored if you would return to our show one day.
I'd enjoy it immensely. You know, you and I, Veronica, have a long-standing connection, and it didn't just start with this life. So
thank you for that. I feel that.
Yes, I always enjoy meeting with my students when we've known each other in the past and bringing all of that into the present life, you see?
Thank you so much, and many, many blessings to you and to Kathleen and all the people you work with.
I thank you, and I'll give you Kathleen.
Thank you.
Well, hi.
Well, that was wonderful. Thank you, Kathleen.
You're very welcome.
I'm very transcendent, and I thank you for the time that we've spent together, and I look forward to more.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and hopefully there will be many more.
Thank you. Many blessings.
Many blessings to you.
Bye. Wow, I love the learning that comes from Dwal Kool. We're going to have three more interviews with him, a whole series. We're going to do that with Galexis as well. So look for those wonderful beings to be interspersed amongst our paradigm shifters over this summer. Thank you so much for listening to our show tonight. And tune in on Thursday night for Jackie Salvitti, ET Healing and Explorations in Consciousness. I get to interview the team, her wonderful channeled beings, and she's a character, will teach you a lot. My own show, it will be at 7 o'clock, and we're talking about fear still and turning fear into love. That's a call-in show, Radiance by Design from 7 to 8. Jackie's from 8 to 9. And if you'd like to be in touch with me, if you have ideas, comments, feedback, Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com, Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com, and if you'd like a session with me, the same address, Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com. Let's call in some love, take it from the universe, and send it out through our hearts to one another, all of us, paradigm shifters. Good night.